Critics and theorists, welcome to episode 2 of Critique of the Podcast Form, a critical theory podcast. Today, it's just me, one of your beloved hosts, James Crane, with J.E. Moren, and we will be discussing... per your suggestions, per your feedback, the political context and content of early critical theory, which is roughly from around the late 1910s through 1950.
Yeah, and that's with kind of, it has sort of rough edges. Most of the focus is going to be around the 1920s and 1930s, if I were to say.
I think that's fair. I mean, it's definitely the most politically exciting time. Not always in a good sense. Okay, so you want to kick things off with the first Marxist work week?
Sure, let's get right into it. So the what we might call the instigating event or the inaugural event for the establishment of the Frankfurt School, which is the Institute for Social Research, the Institut für Soziale Forschung, is an academic conference that was held in 1923 called the First Marxist Work Week. It was sponsored by this guy, Felix Weil, who is a fabulously wealthy German-Argentine student of Karl Korsch, who'll come up again later, who had also previously, for a few years, been an official representative of the Comintern in Latin America under Zinoviev. In his duties as the plenipotentiary representative of the Comintern in Latin America, he had helped to establish the Communist Party of Argentina, which he would go on to be involved with for a number of decades. There were a lot of big names attending this event, including Georg Lukács, Felix Weil himself, of course, Karl Korsch, Karl August Wittfogel, who would go on to become a famous sociologist, Friedrich Pollock, one of the leading figures in the Frankfurt School, Julian Gumperz, who would also go on to be an important member of the Frankfurt School. Most of the people in attendance were aligned, if not actually a member, of the Communist Party of Germany, the KPD.
And that last point is important. I was reading something that was about how there was a debate going on about why it was that so many people attended this conference or joined up with the ISR at this time, who were like much more hardline communists than a lot of our protagonists are going to be. And people have floated theories like, well, you know, they did it in order to provide academic cover, a veneer of respectability, an alibi for, you know, whatever they were up to in Germany at the time. The problem is that wouldn't have worked because of how close and direct the associations were between so many other members of the ISR and the KPD. So the Institute for Social Research opens in 1924 in association with the University of Frankfurt am Main. Crucially, the Institute is independently funded by the Society for Social Research, which was endowed and directed by Felix Weil, his father, and several of his friends, including Horkheimer and Pollock, who are named as co-founding original members. Weil and co. effectively had the power to choose the director, a position that has been described or would come to be described by both Karl Grunberg and Horkheimer, in succession, the first two directors of the ISR. The position would be described as one of having dictatorial power over the Institute. What's important is that the political and intellectual autonomy of the institution and its alignment with socialism, broadly speaking, was guaranteed by the fact that it was privately funded. And this is the kind of autonomy that they wouldn't enjoy in the US once they became beholden to seeking grants for funding around 1939, a state of affairs that would effectively last until 1949, and which Adorno and Horkheimer would describe in private correspondence to each other from the time as artful begging.
Yeah. So just to clarify a little bit about the private funding issue. So because this institution was partnered with the University of Frankfurt, which I believe was at the time a private university. Off the top of my head, I'm not totally sure, but it was under the oversight of state officials. And despite in some ways there being a favorable political climate for socialism in comparison with Imperial Germany, there was still very much a hard line of separation between the socialist movement and the official organs of state. And this was upheld, of course, even by the SPD, the biggest quote-unquote socialist party of the time. And that's why the fact that it was privately funded was so important for guaranteeing its intellectual autonomy. Other important cultural institutions of the time, like Bauhaus, was publicly funded, and they got kicked out of the university they were originally attached to because reactionaries got mad at them, basically. So that's why the private funding was important.
Yeah, and the thing is, the private funding, it did protect them, but it didn't always protect them from like public outrage. So for example, when they started the Marx Engels Archive Project to establish like a publishing house in Frankfurt and create connections with under Riaznov, the Marx Engels Institute in Moscow, to facilitate the connection between them and the SPD, who possessed the archives of the Marx Engels collected works. They named this institution, yeah, something like the Marx Engels Archive. And so for that reason, automatically a bunch of red flags popped up. So they had to fight a bunch of political controversies throughout the 1920s as well around this, despite the fact that they were privately funded. And so they couldn't actually be touched by the same mechanisms that would usually be used to censor comparable institutions in terms of like personnel and radical program. So the first intended founder of, or the first intended head of the Institute for Social Research was actually Kurt Albert Gerlach, a USPD or Independent Social Democrat Party member and self-described anarcho-communist until he died in 1922 at a very young age. And Weil is later going to credit him with the impetus to found the Institute for Social Research. And this is the other thing that's important about the founding, which is that despite the fact that people will often trace it back to something like the first Marxist Work Week, which would have happened technically after, I believe, the Institute, although it didn't have a building yet, was open for operations or had officially been established, the story is different every single time of what the founding looked like, depending on who you ask and at what point, you know, in history you would ask them. So it's much like the Joker, do you want to know how I got these scars, every time the story is different. Pollock will tell a different story. Horkheimer will tell a different story. Felix Weil will tell multiple different versions of the story. But from what we can tell is that the machinery was set into motion in 1922. And things really start to click right around the time the first Marxist Work Week is held. And Gerlach dies a few months before that happens. And so there's a new scramble for a director, and Karl Grunberg is chosen instead.
Yeah. And with regard to Grunberg, his appointment as the head of the Institute is emblematic of the nonpartisan sort of character of its commitment to socialism. Grunberg was, first of all, he was Austrian. He wasn't even German. And secondly, he was basically a completely academic socialist who had previously been a lawyer and had some other sort of, you know, petty bourgeois types of positions. And he wasn't even, I don't believe, a member of the Austrian Social Democratic Party, which was a very large and powerful party. I think they were in the government of Austria at the time in 1924 when the Institute was opened. So it was very much a nonpartisan institute. And this was the only way that they could be affiliated with the university. The individual members of the Institute had a variety of different political affiliations, as we'll talk about later. KPD, SPD, USPD, Council Communism, various other types of affiliations. But it was important that the head of the Institute and the Institute as a body, per se, did not have any direct formalized associations with any of the political parties.
Yeah, like, for example, can you imagine Karl Korsch being named the first director of the Institute? I mean, he was originally floated as one of the prospective candidates for the position, and that would have been an insane choice, even in the early 1920s, because of how vocal he was about, like, a militant communist position. It's one of those things where even other Marxists were a little bit more like, they had a greater distance, let's say, than he did from the most hot-button political issues of the time. So this is something where he had a reputation also for being just like a rampaging contrarian about stuff. So I'm not sure how diplomatic he would have been in such position. There was a potential Hegel Congress that Lukács was planning in the early 30s, and he exchanged some letters with Horkheimer about it. And he was looking for speakers. It was supposed to be this great summit where, honestly, there was going to be like a debate between like the right and the left Hegelians. And Lukács is organizing this, as Horkheimer, who should we have as a speaker? Who else should we invite? Sends him the list. It has right Hegelians like fucking Schmidt on there, and theologians like Paul Tillich. And Horkheimer puts up Korsch's name, and Lukács immediately shoots it down and says no, because first of all, he's not a Marxist in the strict sense of the term, and he's too belligerent for us, and the people on the other side of the room, the right Hegelians, would fucking hate his guts anyway, so he doesn't really fit with either camp. We can't have him here. He's too much of a problem. So that was among Marxists organizing an academic conference, let alone the people who would have been approving or signing off on a decade previous the founding of the Institute for Social Research.
Yes. And just to go down the list of the first few directors here. So as we just mentioned, Karl Grunberg, the Austrian guy, was director. He was the inaugural director from 1924 up until 1927, approximately, when he stepped back from duties due to his declining health. And there was sort of an interregnum period when Pollock, Friedrich Pollock, who we mentioned previously, was the interim director for about a year or two. And he was quite young, so they gave him a lot of power at that point. And then eventually, Horkheimer officially took over the reins as the director in July of 1930. And Horkheimer's own political position, which was dissidence with regard to both the SPD and the KPD, certainly contributed to the fact that he was chosen as director, because he could continue the nonpartisan character of its, the necessarily nonpartisan or lack of partisan commitments, I should say, because he didn't have any.
Yeah. Although, again, as we'll get into, he had some pretty strong connections with certain parts of the left in Weimar Germany. So we have here a broad overview of just, in very quick succession, the series of directors through the 20s into the early 30s of the ISR. And we've covered the importance of it as an independent organ, without which it would definitely not have lasted nearly as long as it did. And we've also talked about sort of like how this independence would be instrumental for the output of the Institute through the late 1930s. So at this point, we're going to move on to some stronger political connections that the founding members had with left movements in Weimar politics. So first off,
Just briefly before that, we should mention that in 1933, the Institute was shut down almost immediately after the Nazis took power because they were believed to be a communist organization.
Yeah.
Which resulted in the flight of most of the members out of Germany. Many of them eventually ended up in the United States. A couple, I think, maybe stayed in a couple of other countries, but most of them ended up in the United States eventually.
Yeah, but it was under the pretext of the law that warranted the seizure of assets by known communists who were, you know, culpable for activities in hostility to the Prussian state or something like that. Moving on to some of the more specific political connections. So Felix Weil was incredibly sympathetic with the founders of the KPD and was convinced, as per his theoretical project of the early 1920s, that socialization was impossible without something like revolution. However, he never officially joined the party, and this was out of his desire to remain independent, given that party discipline likely would have extended to dictating the use of his assets and income. So both Felix Weil's sympathy with the communists and his reluctance to join the KPD were fruits of his friendship with Clara Zetkin, who at one point he became her self-appointed bodyguard. He heard some rumors when he was hanging out with other members of the socialist student group he helped found in Tübingen. He heard rumors that some of them were going to attack Clara Zetkin in Stuttgart. So he drove with his friend and like a single pistol up to Stuttgart and said basically that they were there to save her life. And so she joined them. She went with them in the car, stayed with them for about a week and didn't go back to Stuttgart until she had arranged for like a private bodyguard. And so she called him her rescuer. And he called her my dear maternal friend. So they had a pretty close relationship at the beginning of the 1920s. And she really came in after sort of the intellectual influence of Karl Korsch on Felix Weil, which has been discussed very extensively. It was really this connection with Clara Zetkin that solidified his commitment to something like a revolutionary project for socialization, but that also made him suspicious of the KPD, at least insofar as he thought that it would be a restriction on the free disposal of his significant assets that he wanted to use to become like the preeminent patron of radical left theoretical and artistic production in Weimar Germany.
So that's some background about Weil. There were two members of the Institute that had some involvement with the Zionist movement in their early years. They're in their, 20s, early 30s maybe? It was in the 1920s in any case. One of the main ones was Erich Fromm. He became involved in the Zionist movement from about 1920 to 1923. Something that's interesting about Fromm's involvement is that he was not a secular Zionist like the majority of the Zionist movement at the time. He was somewhat innovative in this regard, a religious Zionist, which is increasingly the dominant position in the worldwide Zionist movement today and in the politics of Israel. However, Fromm's religiosity overcame his opposition to Zionism in the mid-1920s, and he later recalled that when he left the Zionist movement, he wrote a dramatic open letter to the other members of the movement in 1923 that he privately believed that they were, and this is his own words, no better than swastika wearers, meaning the Nazi party. The word he uses is Hakenkreuzer. And once he left Zionism, he drifted slowly more and more towards first a sort of utopian romantic socialism, and then eventually towards a more solidly Marxist position as the 1920s came to a close.
You want me to jump in for the Lewenthal?
Yeah, please do.
All right. So Leo Lewenthal, to use the anglicized version of pronouncing his name, or Lewenthal, flirted with Zionism in the early 1920s, mostly out of an oppositional stance towards what he perceived as the conservatism of his parents' assimilationism. And this was in parallel with his membership to several like student socialist groups at the time when he was in university. He became involved in various Jewish cultural institutions, many of them non-Zionist, as he gradually grew apart from Zionism in the mid-20s. And by the late 1920s, he would reject both Jewish orthodoxy and Zionism definitively for a more secular and socialist politics. And so Gershom Scholem would later complain about his former, you know, compatriots in both non-Zionist and Zionist Jewish cultural organizations and institutions. He would complain about them from Lewenthal. He would say that they had their Orthodox Judaism analyzed away. The corrupting influence of psychoanalysis was in part to blame for their drifting from Zionism as a project, whether religious or secular. And in part, this was because of their involvement at Frieda Reichmann's psychoanalytic sanatorium, which Reichmann founded with Fromm's help in the mid-1920s and closed in 28, which sort of the time that they spent there especially is the period in which they did definitively move away from Zionism as a political and religious project.
Yeah. Fromm, or maybe it was Reichmann. I think Reichmann told a story years later about how she and Fromm, who were married at the time, had a sudden sort of the reverse of a come to Jesus movement, where they were sitting out in a park bench one day and they just decided, fuck kosher, and they decided to just go eat some pork.
Incredible.
Kind of a ridiculous sort of act of sacrilege that symbolize their turning away from religious commitments towards full-on atheism and Marxist psychoanalytic crap. Fromm would remain an atheist the rest of his life, but later in his life, he developed what he called an atheist mysticism and a critical appropriation of religion. Those are some interesting episodes from the likes of Eric Fromm and Leo Löwenthal. Various members of the Frankfurt School were also involved during their days in university with student groups aligned with the major parties of the day. That's the USPD, the Independent Social Democrats, the KPD, the Communists, and the Spartacus League, which was the predecessor to the Communist Party. Leo Löwenthal was involved with a student group affiliated with the USPD, as was Carl August Wittfogel, and Felix Weil, as was previously mentioned, was the sort of leader, I guess, of a student group that was aligned with the Spartacus League and then later the Communist Party.
So one of the big questions that has preoccupied my research as of late is about Horkheimer's political education. And so we know a few things. Some of these are better established than others in the traditional reception. We know that he becomes a socialist in the very final months of World War I. And we know that this is in part because of sympathies for Luxembourg and Liebknecht. It turns out, actually, that well before the fall of 1918, back in the fall of 1917, he writes this open letter kind of literary thing, which is a confession or profession of my politics. And in this, which may or may not be written from the perspective of Jesus, it's not very clear. It's very experimental in literary terms. It ends with an hallucinatory dream sequence of Horkheimer watching, or the author, watching his lover try and fail to visit Liebknecht in prison in her dream. And so this is one of the places where already when, you know, he was still supposedly an anti-political or apolitical individualist aesthete, as he was for most of World War I, mostly just opposed to war. He was intransigently anti-war from the beginning, and he hated the Social Democrats for being a pseudo-opposition party. Already, though, in 1917, he seems to have had the sense that there was a real opposition out there, and that would have been, at the time, the USPD, which I believe Luxembourg and Liebknecht were a part of. So this is sort of the background for what happens when he ends up in Munich in fall 1918, and he gets to leave the sanatorium where he had been locked for having incredibly poor health during the last few months of the war when he was a soldier. They basically took him off the battlefield. He was just way too sickly. He's released into Munich right before shit hits the fan. So he makes the acquaintance of several important revolutionaries from the upcoming November Revolution in Bavaria, and then what would be the Munich Soviet Republic, the short-lived Munich Soviet Republic the following spring. So he meets with them. He's having debates in like artistic salons with his friend, the photographer Germain Krull. He's like fighting with Ernst Toller and defending Liebknecht and Luxembourg. And this is, again, he has never really been political before, and boy, does he come out fucking swinging. So this happens in the fall of 1918, right before things pop off in October. he expresses, and we don't have very much of a record of what happens during the November Revolution that winter, or even the following spring into the Munich Soviet Republic. We don't have a very good record of what Horkheimer and Pollock are up to. We know that they are sympathetic, but they're also skeptical and maintain a distance from it. We also know that Horkheimer was a vigorous reader of Die Aktion, the literary magazine that was super hot for both expressionist young artistic types and for people who were very invested in sort of a broad sampling of left political texts that they otherwise wouldn't have access to. So this is like they would publish an entire issue that would have like Schopenhauer quotes on love next to like Bakunin and Engels. So it was very, and you know, next to some Alfred Dublin. So it was very eclectic in that sense, and it sort of explains the position that he's coming from. You have something here?
If I can briefly tag in about Die Aktion, this was a paper that started out as definitely leaning towards literature, increasingly just became mostly politics during the early 1920s, where most of the pages were occupied with political stuff from what I've read of it. And you didn't just get stuff by German authors, Rosa Luxemburg, Karl Liebknecht, important speeches by Eugene Levinet, who was one of the, Eugen Levinet, who was one of the leaders of the Munich Soviet Republic, and Kurt Eisner, Ernst Toller, all these other people. It had published both in the paper itself and in the publishing house, works by Lenin, Bukharin, Zinoviev, Bogdanov, among other, Kropotkin eventually. It starts turning towards an anarchist position in the year 1921. And so they bring in a lot of council communist guys. Jan Appel is writing in here, Otto Ruhle, Anton Panikowicz even. So anyone who was reading this would have been exposed to a very broad range of perspectives from the communist movement. And it was very openly identified as a communist paper, not a socialist paper.
And so, like, if you want to know, like, what Horkheimer's politics are, not just at any given time, from basically, like, 1914 through the early to mid-1920s, but, like, over the whole span, what his politics could best be summed up in, it would be sort of like the table of contents of Die Aktion. So he sort of follows the trajectory of radicalization for, you know, the founder, the head editor of Die Aktion, Femford. And so at one point he even meets him. We might get into that story a little bit later. But for right now, it's this broad perspective that he's coming from. He doesn't see a difference in that sense eventually between sort of the expressionist, anarchist aesthete tendencies of his youth and the sort of sharp communist politicization of his own thought or that of the magazine. He takes them all to be part and parcel of the same sort of oppositional position. And that basically informs his position for, I think, much of his life, funnily enough. It's sort of the trajectory of Die Aktion.
You have a quote prepared from Horkheimer from one of his letters. Do you want to read this out?
Yeah, this is actually, so this is quoted from Germain Krull's biography. So Germain Krull's biography is one of the best sources that we have of what Horkheimer was up to in, Horkheimer and Pollock were up to in Munich in 1918, fall 1918 through basically early fall 1919. And Horkheimer in late summer 1919, and this is after, should we get into like their involvement with the communists during the White Terror?
Sure, why not?
All right.
You can get into that now.
So the first time that Horkheimer and Pollock ever really get involved in politics, despite being sympathetic with, if distant from, Luxembourg and Liebknecht in fall 1918 through the founding of the Munich Soviet Republic, later in spring.
November is when the revolution starts, and then it takes on the explicitly communist character in spring of the next year.
Yeah. So During that whole time, though, as far as we can tell, they were sympathetic but distant from it. They become most politically engaged during the repression. So it's not that they were enthusiastically out there on the streets, you know, like shouting communist slogans, and then, you know, were sort of sobered by the failure of the revolutionary movement. And this is one of the more traditional narratives that's actually told about their experience of revolutionary Munich. They actually only became involved and really invested in sort of clandestine underground activities in or during the White Terror after the White Army and the Freikorps came to crush the Munich Soviet Republic. So they become involved at this point. They're the ones who are, they're helping shelter some of the central figures from particularly the communist second phase of the Soviet Republic. Again, Horkheimer was already debating Ernst Toller back in October, the year before defending Liebknecht in Luxembourg, was not a huge fan of Ernst Toller's directorship, or whatever you could call it, his time as head of the executive of the Munich Soviet Republic. He would have been much more sympathetic to the communist phase in the middle under Eugene Levine and Tobias Axelrod. And he would actually, he and Pollock would help put up Tobias Axelrod for a short period of time in their apartment there. They would also house another person who was close friends with Eugene Levine. And some of their associates at that time were just like getting shot in the fucking street, like blocks away from where they lived. So they were involved specifically in the clandestine stuff, in the organizing stuff to do like legal organizing on behalf of people who had been imprisoned in the wake of the suppression of the Soviet Republic. So anyway, this is after that, and after Horkheimer and Germain Krall went on an ill-fated voyage across the German countryside, driving around trying to curry support for Tobias Axelrod's case before he ended up getting murdered like Eugene Levine or Gustav Landauer. So at one point in that road trip, that crazy summer, they ended up at Femfert's house, the chief editor of Die Aktion, and he had recently just been censured for publishing stuff that was way too radical, and so there was a temporary pause on publishing. He was effectively fucked, and he could not help them either. So they returned to Munich, and at this point, Horkheimer is said to give this sort of speech to Krall and Pollock, the other two members of the Best Friends Gang from late 1918 to fall 1919. And he says, there are two types of revolution, not just one type. There was a revolution in the streets and it was inspiring, but the streets now mean death. All the great leaders are dead. Rosa Luxemburg, Karl Liebknecht, Kurt Eisner, etc. The reaction is strong now, associated with the socialist government. The reaction is always well organized because it has money and weapons. The second way of making revolution consists in entering into the government and sabotaging it. This type of revolution is not bad and can, in the long run, even be better. Karl Marx says when the revolution in the streets is over, it is necessary to enter into the government and sabotage it. Thus, there are two methods, but conflicts can also arise because some might say that the revolution in the streets is over and others might say that it is still alive. I am afraid that Lenin, as a good Marxist, realizes that the revolution in the streets is over. And this is what explains, according to his biographers like John Abramite, the turn that Horkheimer has to trying to understand sort of the broader social context, the causes of the waves, the successive waves of revolution and reaction that he had experienced in Munich over the course of the previous year.
Someone who had some similar experiences, albeit not in Munich, but in Berlin, was Herbert Marcuse. So he had been drafted into the army. I think he had some stupid ass position. I can't remember if it was him or Horkheimer, who was basically a stable boy. But one of them had that position. I think it might have been Hork. He joined the SPD in 1917 and began studying Marx. He gets drafted the following year, 1918. When the revolution comes, he gets elected to a soldiers' council and then almost immediately leaves when a bunch of ex-officers get elected to the council alongside him. And then the following year, he leaves the SPD out of disgust. And from that point onward, he pursues his education and interest in Marx in a more academic vein until like the 1960s, when he again becomes very politically active, as is well known. Marcuse did not discuss this very much. And there's not really any good biographies of him written, I guess because he didn't talk about this that much. But in one discussion with some students in 1967, he gave some insight into his stance at the time, and I would say his continuing stance on problems related to revolution, reformism, and so on. So the student brings up some charge of reformism or something, and Marcuse says this: "Let me say something personal. If you mean by revisionism the German Social Democratic Party, I can only say to you that from the time of my own political education, that is, since 1919, I have opposed this party. In 1917 to 1918, I was a member of the Social Democratic Party. I resigned from it after the murder of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. And from then on, I have criticized this party's politics. Not because it believed that it could work within the framework of the established order, for we all do this. We all make use of even the most minute possibilities in order to transform the established order from inside it. That is not why I fought the SPD. The reason was rather that it worked in alliance with reactionary, destructive, and repressive forces." And I think this stance that Marcuse outlines here of opposing the SPD, not simply because they were reformist or whatever, but because they were very blatantly, actively reactionary and violently suppressing the revolutionary movement in Germany at the time, was pretty widely held amongst members of the Institute. Not just the leading members, but even lesser known members, as we sort of get into in a little bit.
Yeah.
So Horkheimer, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, this is even going to be true of people who are primarily known for their affiliation with the SPD later in the 1920s, when it's a very different kind of political party than it was at the beginning of the 1920s. But this is like Franz Neumann and Otto Kirchheimer, for example, are still not going to fuck with this era of the SPD for that reason, like the SPD that oversaw the founding of the Weimar Republic and the institution of the Constitution. So even those who are going to be more explicitly associated with the SPD are going to be pretty intransigently opposed to the SPD of this era.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning when we talk about the SPD is that the exact composition of the political parties was in complete flux during the early 1920s. A gigantic portion of the SPD's membership left to join the Independent Social Democrats. This is everyone from Kautsky, the quote-unquote Pope of Marxism, to Edward Bernstein, the inventor of revisionism, also left to join the Independents because he was so disgusted with the SPD. And then the Independent Social Democrats liquidated themselves into the Communist Party, becoming the United Communist Party of Germany. And then everyone who was left over from the independents who didn't want to join the communist, generally, they went back into the SPD after a few years. And when a bunch of other different organizations slowly disintegrated over the course of the 1920s, more and more people gravitated back towards the SPD. And so by the later part of the 1920s, there were plenty of members, especially in the lower levels and just in the voting bloc and not being necessarily a nomenklatura of the SPD, who were not of the Friedrich Ebert, Gustav Noske, you know, crush all of the Bolsheviks persuasion. It's important to remember that when we talk about the SPD.
Yeah.
Some people like Marcuse, though, did not forgive them. They fucking hated them for the rest of their life, though.
like we brought up a little bit earlier, Kurt Gerlach, the intended first director of the ISR, who described himself as an anarcho-communist and was part of, I think it was the SPD or the USPD. Like, he wasn't even a part of the Communist Party. So, you know, things were very much in flux at the time. So, and you have a note here on specifically the relationships that they have with the KPD, yeah?
Yeah. So there were three sort of big name members that people might have heard of. One of them is more famous than the other ones, who were members of the Communist Party. And that's Julian Gumperz, Karl August Wittfogel, and Franz Borkenau. All three of these people eventually became hardline anti-communists. Borkenau even became a stockbroker in America. And he authored some crazy book. I don't remember what it's called. It's called Plan for World Revolution or something. And it's about, he wrote it on a crazy synonym. It was like Upsilon Sigma or something. It's about his experiences in the Comintern, basically. Gumperz and Wittfogel, on the other hand, kept on the academic path. They both became great theoreticians of totalitarianism. Wittfogel infamously participated in the McCarthy hearings, tattletaling on other people. Some people had to leave the country because of what Wittfogel said about them. One person even committed suicide as a result of it. And this was quite a shift for Wittfogel, because well into the 1930s, and even for some years after moving to America, if you believe people who talked to him, he was still very much committed to the KPD. Wittfogel was in fact imprisoned in a concentration camp for about a year due to being a KPD member, and because he was attempting to flee over the border to Switzerland. But some influential friends, including this guy, Karl Haushofer, who was like one of the biggest like Nazi adjacent social scientists in Germany at the time, helped get him out of the concentration camp, from whence he eventually arrived in the United States, and then later on became completely, you know, conservative, liberal, anti-communist, we must defend Western civilization against Russian menace type of guy.
There's, well, I mean, Wittfogel is also funny because, like, in, what was it, 39, when the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was signed, and there's a specific restaurant, I forget what the name of the restaurant is, but they all remember it as the blank restaurant affair later on, even into the late 40s, where Wittfogel is there with, like, Adorno, who is had just recently officially joined the ISR in New York in, I think, late 38, early 39. Adorno, Pollock, Horkheimer, Lewenthal, Marcuse, probably Neumann. I don't remember who else would have been there. Grossman definitely would have, because I think he took Wittfogel's side. They were all sitting down at a table at this like restaurant in New York. And at one point, Horkheimer makes a crack about how Stalin seems ready for an even stronger alliance with Hitler or something like that, conditions permitting. And Wittfogel like stands up and starts fucking screaming in the restaurant, and they just get into a shouting match until like Wittfogel has to leave. So they continue to work together after this. So this kind of dispute was not even infrequent in the late 30s. So he was pretty hardline about this shit, even well past the point that people who were more on the side of like left dissident communists like Horkheimer, who at the time, Karl Korsch writes in a letter to Paul Maddock, basically agrees with us. He just has a system of, this is what Korsch called double entry bookkeeping, to sort of cover over the more communist sides of his work. This was like not something uncommon for them to do internally in disputes at the ISR at the time. But yeah, Wittfogel was pretty hardline up until like the late 30s. So his pivot in the mid 40s, I think it was, is pretty sharp. And it's pretty surprising. And I think it also potentially implicated Felix Weil at one point. It's definitely implicated, who is it, Hans Eisler?
No, not Eisler. He moved to East Germany and became like the composer of the GDR national anthem.
Oh, one of his relatives then or something like that, who stayed in the United States, I believe. Well, anyway, there was shit was flying everywhere and he was pointing fingers. So it was a pretty sharp turn in the mid 40s.
Speaking of the GDR, one member who ended up there was Henryk Grossman, who is a Polish fellow who was quite a bit older than most of the other members. He had been a veteran of several different Polish socialist parties throughout the late 19th century, early 20th century. He kind of got driven out of Poland for being a socialist and then sort of communist activist. He was invited by Grunberg, who had known him in a previous life in Austria. He had studied in Austria before. Invited by Grunberg to join the Institute in 1924, so one of the founding members. As a sort of old style of Marxist. He got into arguments with the likes of Adorno, Horkheimer, and Pollock a lot, very frequently. He had eventually had an unamicable breakup with them in the 1940s. And then in 1950, he moved to the GDR, newly established at that point, intending to take up a position as a professor. But unfortunately, he died shortly thereafter from some medical issues that he was suffering from.
So there's, and this is part of the interesting thing about, and I think Grossman really sort of helps frame what we're going to discuss next, which is the strange relationship that the Institute had to more orthodox schools of Marxism. And this is something that comes out, so in the 1920s, for instance, the collaboration between the Institute for Social Research and Riaznov's Marx-Engels Institute during Grunberg's tenure in particular. So the Institute was an essential intermediary between the SPD, which controlled Marx and Engels' literary estate, and who were very reluctant to have any interactions with communist parties at all. But they were the intermediaries between the SPD and Riaznov's Marx-Engels Institute in Moscow, acting as the official organ for the Communist Party of the USSR. So members of the Institute had access to copies of the newly discovered manuscripts from Marx and Engels and translations of the latest and most important works of Marxist theory from the USSR. So this is one of the interesting places where the distinction between Eastern and Western Marxism tends to fall apart. So for example, Isaac Rubin's writings on Marxist theory of value were incredibly important for the theoretical development of the early Frankfurt School. Even in like Pollock's classes, I believe, Rubin's works were treated as sort of like canonical texts, and they would have been published in one of these these collaborations between Riaznov's Marx-Engels Institute and Grunberg's Institute for Social Research in the late 20s. They also had, for this reason, access to a lot of parts of the German ideology that other people hadn't seen. They had access to Marx's letters with Vera Zasulich on Marx's theory of history in the Russian Mir. They had access to all of this stuff, and then a bunch of Engels, I know, from like 1925 on. And basically, without the Institute for Social Research doing this kind of, establishing these kinds of relationships between the Marx-Engels Institute and the SPD, there wouldn't have been the Mega One volumes that came out. I think one of them in the late 20s and then the rest of them by 1933.
So those were just some sort of historical facts, historical background. We're going to kind of segue our discussion into more of a discussion of their theoretical work and the political content of that.
So following up on our discussion of sort of the historical facts and the connections that various members of the Institute had to radical politics around the time of its founding through the 1920s, I think we've even focused on almost exclusively up until this point, we can start talking about the political content of the Frankfurt School's theory, because they make continuous reference to the failed German Revolution from the period of 1918, fall 1918, through like the suppression of the Ruhr Army uprising in 1919 through 1921. So there's, in that sense, and also with the suppression of the people who suppressed the Kapp-Putsch, this is going to be a touchstone of their theoretical work in a way that is almost constantly neglected. So there's a famous quote from Horkheimer that I'll pull up very briefly, which is from an essay that he authors in the late 1930s as a criticism of Siegfried Marx's philosophy of absolute concentration. And so here, let me pull up this quote. Horkheimer writes in this essay in 1938, "The spoils which fall to the fascist belong to him by right. He is the legitimate son and heir of liberalism. The wealthiest estates have nothing to reproach him with. Even the most extreme horrors of today have their origins not in 1933, but in 1919, in the shooting of workers and intellectuals by the feudal accomplices of the First Republic. The socialist governments were essentially powerless. Instead of advancing down to the very basis of these events, they preferred to remain on the loose topsoil of the facts. In secret, they held the theory to be a quirk. The government made freedom a matter of political philosophy instead of political practice. Even those who may privately have every reason to do so should not wish humanity to repeat this. It would run the very same course as the original." So this is the extent to which, you know, the suppression of really the revolutionary communist movement in Germany around 1920 is going to be a constant theoretical touchstone of their work going forward.
Yeah. So one thing that I think we need to get out of the way before we talk about the political content in more detail is the constant use of coded language in their writing. One of the main sort of code words they'll use is rationality, reason, rational, various synonyms for those sorts of words. So instead of socialism or communism, they'll say a rational society. They'll describe a market economy and then say a rational society, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, would not do this. Or they'll say, you know, class divisions, this has nothing to do with a truly rational society, where they're saying it in all but name. And even to some extent, even the term critical theory itself is in some contexts a code word for Marxism or historical materialism.
Yeah, this is the thing where, and it begins all the way back with, I think it's even in like Felix Weil's dissertation or something like that, where everyone tells him he has to start using coded words, or as he'll put it, Aesopian language. This applies to the name the Institute for Social Research itself, which was originally going to have a name like the Marxist Institute for Communist Studies or something. And then they quickly decided that that would be too provocative and changed it to the Institute for Social Research. This was in a conversation with Pollock and Horkheimer, I believe. But the reason that they continue to use these sort of more neutral sounding or Aesopian terms, it goes all the way back to the early 1920s as well. And it's going to be a pretty standard practice even before the Nazis take over, even before they end up in the United States. So, for example, the coded language of rational society is cribbed almost like one-to-one from certain passages whenever they describe this rational society, from like one or two paragraphs of the German ideology in the first section, or from the description of the associated free producers or the realm of freedom from Capital volumes 1 and 3 respectively. So they're not hiding it all that well, although some of the stuff definitely gets lost in translation. But this is something where it's pretty on the nose for the people who are in the know, so to speak. So the self-censorship, though, is going to pre-exist the rise of the Nazis. It's going to pre-exist their emigration to the United States in the 1930s. It's going to take on different forms according to various contexts and demands that are placed on them. So, for example, their censorship policy changes radically when all of a sudden they try to start publishing in France, in especially the mid to late 1930s, when they're trying to become sort of a more international organ. They're trying to make the Zeitschrift für Soziale Forschung a more international organ. And so they have to work with French censors. Then they also switch this up in the 1940s, when they have to all of a sudden start sending out research applications for grants and funding from external sources in the United States over and over again for about a decade. So anyway, this is just sort of the context of their self-censorship. It's a permanent part of their work, and unfortunately not something that has been very well studied, in part because of how difficult it is to reconstruct the process of the composition of the text and then the revision and the censorship of the texts.
And it's worth also mentioning that some of the members were a little bit more lax about this. Marcuse in particular kind of couldn't be bothered to go through the censorship procedures a lot of the time. One of his essays is just a very long treatment of the concept of authority in Lenin. It hasn't been translated into English, unfortunately. It's only in German. But yeah, sometimes they would kind of ignore the censorship principle if they felt they could get away with it. We've already sort of mentioned their attitudes towards the existing parties. So they were clearly against the SPD insofar as it represented a distinctively reactionary form of reformism. But they weren't necessarily abstentionists, as Marcuse's own comment above sort of indicated. Likewise, they were against the sort of primitive insurrectionary style of the early KPD. That's from about 1920 to 1923, when they keep trying to organize these insurrections with a lot of prodding from Zinoviev over in Moscow about it as well. But they were not opposed to insurrection in principle. They just thought that it had to be, you know, you shouldn't play with people's lives, basically, which is kind of what they saw the KPD sometimes doing, I think. But despite their criticism of both these parties, they worked with current and former members of both of them and managed to stay relatively aloof from a lot of the sectarian disputes, like the blow-up about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact we previously mentioned. Given the amount of people of different persuasions working in the Institute, it's incredible that more people did not just quit because they had to work with people they politically disliked. Because, you know, you had people from all across the socialist communist spectrum working there.
So in their attitude towards the USSR, and this is something that I think also tends not to get too much attention, in part because they placed a prohibition on explicit criticism, I think, through the 30s and into the late 40s on the USSR in particular. This was a conscious decision. They were in favor of some form of planned economy in a limited sense, in that they thought that economic planning was just going to be sort of the next phase in economics. And they, you know, took inspiration for this from sources like everyone from when they would generate, especially in the early issues of the ZFS, sort of like these massive essays doing book reviews of everyone from like right wingers to people in the Soviet Union, to like liberal Keynesians, sort of giving arguments for and critiques of planned economies. So they thought that there was a right way to do this, and they thought that that was going to look more like socialist planning than not, although they were always skeptical of the substitution, you could say, of socialist planning for communism or the association of the free producers, which they understood actually in a councilist sense of the dictatorship of the proletariat should, as soon as possible or immediately, hand that over to the Association of the Free Producers. So, but they were willing to tolerate sort of like theories of economic planning so long as they were pushing in the direction of something like socialist experiments.
Yeah. And related to this, as I mentioned before, you'll find constant criticism of the irrationality of markets, the irrationality of class divisions, criticism of commodity fetishism. They were one of the primary people in this time period who brought attention to that theory. Like we said before, they were influenced in this capacity by the likes of Lukács and probably as well Isaac Ilyich Rubin from the USSR. So you'll find a lot of talk about commodity fetishism, reification, so on. All of that is obviously very consciously directed at the principle of market economies and the necessary forms of social domination and privation that those produce. With regard to the USSR in particular, they have what you could call a cautiously optimistic viewpoint at first in the early 1920s, that becomes more and more pessimistic. And finally, they sort of decide that the current government of the USSR is a problem with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. However, they still believe that the USSR is obviously a force for good against the Nazis, and they do not engage in like totalitarianism theory, at least during the time period we're talking about. Although I think people like Adorno will never engage in it. Horkheimer and Friedrich Pollack in particular, you have more of an argument that maybe they did it a little bit. And it's interesting, in the early 1940s or late 1930s, they have almost a sort of Trotskyist style position about the USSR, which is that they don't like the current government, but they still believe that it's like the closest to socialism. And if there could be like some kind of second revolution of some sort in the USSR, that would be, you know, a really revolutionary moment for the entire world. And that would be able to restore all of the impetus that was lost since 1917 or whatever.
Yeah, they're basically going to call for like a second revolution in the USSR. This is going to be one of the things where they like are hoping for it, I think, from the late 1920s through the late 1940s. And they're going to think about the second revolution in terms of councilism and council communism as sort of a critique of the misapprehension of what is revolutionary about the Soviet experience and experiment by the Soviet government themselves. So this is going to be sort of their weird, sometimes again, yeah, like J.E. said, sometimes it's going to sound Trotskyist. They were, none of them were ever Trotskyist, which is also interesting that they were never technically a part of any of those, like, those cells or sects. Again, they were non-sectarian about this stuff, which basically put them outside of Trotskyism at the time. But they are going to want something like a second revolution to occur throughout this period of time. So this is going to be in the essays like Authoritarian State, for example, and as a joke about their censorship mechanisms, at one point Horkheimer will literally, and this is after Authoritarian State, which is written in 40, 41 with Adorno, and is released in 42 in the Walter Benjamin Memorial issue. Horkheimer's going to write to Lewenthal asking him to please cut out those pages from a copy of the Memorial issue that they want to send to an associate who Horkheimer doesn't want to read like his explicitly communist stuff, and says, basically, do a dog ate my homework. Ah, it got lost in the mail. There was never another essay in this issue kind of thing. So it's pretty comedic at times, the lengths that they'll go to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah. In terms of positive identifications, we mentioned they weren't Trotskyists. It's kind of comical. It doesn't come up at all, even though they were in New York City, which is the Trotskyist movement in America was pretty big there. They do not give a fuck at all about Trotskyism. It doesn't come up whatsoever. But one tradition that they do pay a little bit more attention to is the German Council Communist tradition. So as previously mentioned, that a number of connections with Karl Korsch in particular. Also, once they moved to the U.S., they developed some connections with Paul Maddock and the International Council Correspondence Group, the magazine Living Marxism, and so on. Horkheimer, as we previously mentioned, was a reader of Die Aktion. So he would have been well acquainted with the perspectives of the KAPD, that's the Communist Workers' Party of Germany, and in particular with Otto Rühle's anti-party council communism, which was developed in the early 1920s and heavily promoted in the pages of Die Aktion, which had some shit by Rühle in it every couple of issues. This sort of legacy can be seen in some of Horkheimer's more explicitly political essays from the 40s and 30s, where insofar as he does discuss issues of revolution, there's a heavy focus on the idea of councils and the idea of council democracy. And there is not very much of a focus on the role of any sort of political party. There's an interesting thing where, much like the early KAPD, there is an idea of a dictatorship of the proletariat, but it is conceived along the lines of a dictatorship exercised through councils, through Soviets, not through the rule of a party.
And that'll be consistent through like 1946 is the one of the latest times that I found a fragment that explicitly calls for this, co-authored by Adorno and Horkheimer. So this is one of the things where the consistency is kind of astonishing when you follow through like the self-administration, the universal self-administration by individuals of the productive forces. This is going to be the core idea, for example, that Adorno seems to take even from some of Korsch's writings in the 20s. But Adorno is going to seems to apply this in his 42 Theses on Need, the very famous document about how in a republic of councils in a Soviet republic, not all of the wheels would have to turn. Play on the word, you know, like a Rete Republic. So Horkheimer is going to repeatedly call for a version of free association that he's going to identify with councilist democracy as the model. I was just told that I have to stop using the word famous to refer to texts like Adorno's Theses on Need. Fair enough. Note. So there's going to be a very selective reading that's paired alongside this of Lenin and other Leninist figures like Bukharin, who Horkheimer and Pollock are going to read in 1919, and they're going to be super jazzed about back when Bukharin was still writing sort of the left communist.
Bukharin was a fucking insane guy, and he wanted to declare war on the entire world.
That's the Bukharin that they love. That's the one that they love, like the program for the communists in 1918. And then there's also going to be a selective appropriation of Lukács, of course, especially for Adorno, who's closer to this shit. It's one of the things where we were looking for more information on specifically Adorno's political radicalization. And it seems like it was in large part through being super fucking impressed with Lukács' work in the early 1920s that accounts for a lot of his radicalization, that and hanging out with a bunch of radicals like Horkheimer and Pollock and Felix Weil. So this is going to be, this selective reading is a trait common to Horkheimer, Adorno, Marcuse, Fromm, and others. And this is one of the things where, according to the ideals of the 1919 Munich Soviet Republic, particularly for Horkheimer and Marcuse, but also for the others, there's going to be a strong identification that many of them are going to have, especially the core members, less so those who were affiliated explicitly with the KPD, even those affiliated with the SPD throughout the 20s. But for those, let's say, like unaffiliated left dissident communist members of the ISR, they're going to retain a strong identification with Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht throughout the period that we're discussing, basically ending in 1950. So this is one of the other things where they don't see it as, let's say, like, they don't see it because, and this is part of the weirdness of their non-sectarian position, despite having a very specific line on like the role of the Soviets in the revolutionary process at different points. Part of their non-sectarianism is that they identify with Liebknecht and Luxemburg's positions from before a lot of these divisions really came about, these sharp sectarian divisions between the councilist wing and the Bolshevist wing, the divisions that would become so important in later in the 1920s into the 1930s. So that sort of accounts for their amorphousness with respect to that.
With regard to the reading of Lenin, it's very sort of comical with regard to Fromm in particular, because well into like the 1960s, when they're selling his books in drugstores and shit, he'll just randomly drop, you know, references to Lenin in there. And you like Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin, it'll be like, clearly, you know, this is different from Stalin or whatever. Which is very funny to do when you're selling books that are called like The Art of Being Alive or whatever.
The Art of Live, Laugh, Love.
And then The Art of Living is, I think, actually a book he wrote. With regard to the Munich Soviet Republic, this was sort of a more powerful symbol in some ways than the Spartacist uprising, because the Munich Soviet Republic, like the initial seizure of power, basically happened almost without firing a single shot, they basically just got a giant crowd together, and it was a very diverse crowd of workers, intellectuals. They had this giant, I think this guy with one eye, who was a leader of the local Peasants League, marching with them. So you had basically all the relevant sectors of society, the intellectuals, the workers, the peasants, marching together and just going from like barracks to barracks, recruiting all of the soldiers to join up in their Red Guard, people, you know, tying red cloth around their arm and all this stuff, marching arm in arm, driving the king of Bavaria out of his palace and then retiring to literally hang out for the night in a beer house. Stuff like that happening was sort of like, for the likes of Horkheimer and Marcuse in particular, who was really concerned with like what he calls the aesthetic dimension of reality and existence, this type of like spontaneous, harmonious existence arising in a revolutionary movement was incredibly compelling to them. And it was something that Marcuse would continue to reference into like the 1960s. In the 70s, even.
This is something where, and I'm glad that you brought this up, because the experience that they had in Munich in particular, there was, and so I'm going to read from Rosa Levine Meyer on the beginning of the second phase of the Munich Soviet Republic around April 13th, 1919. She writes in her biography of her late husband, Eugene Levine. The streets were filled with workers, armed and unarmed, who marched by in detachments or stood reading the proclamations. Lorries loaded with armed workers raced through the town, often greeted with jubilant cheers. The bourgeoisie had disappeared completely. The trams were not running. All cars had been confiscated and were being used exclusively for official purposes. Thus, every car that whirled past became a symbol, reminding people of the great changes. Aeroplanes hovered over the town and thousands of leaflets fluttered through the air in which the Hoffman government pictured the horrors of Bolshevik rule and praised the democratic government who would bring peace, order, and bread. In the evening, all leaders assembled in a huge hall of the Wittelsbach Palace, the seat of the new government. Hard work with almost permanent committee sessions lay ahead. Suddenly, somebody started singing the Internationale, the others followed, and the royal palace resounded with the ecstatic voices of a bizarre crowd choking with emotion, much closer in appearance to a dedicated church congregation than to tough communists. I cried, and some of the ruthless, bloodthirsty criminals were struggling to suppress their own tears. That's the experience that they're going to hold on to for the rest of their lives. Well, it was also, and this is just the last thing I want to say about the Munich and the ideals, it was also pretty goofy as an affair, because the permanent council sessions that Rosa Levine Meyer mentions were people bringing up like utopian schemes about like redrawing the maps and stuff like that, and designing new songs and outfits for, you know, the revolutionary Munich Soviet Republic. At the same time, they were having like fierce debates between Ernst Toller and Eugene Levine, for example, about whether or not the workers should be armed. As like the White Army, the specter of the White Army was looming above their heads. This is one of the exciting things about the very short-lived Munich Soviet Republic. And they were very sober about like the reasons why it failed. They didn't think it had to by any merit of historical necessity. But they also didn't think that it was, you know, inherently perfect. And this is, as we've mentioned before, they were sympathetic to it, but they were also skeptical and at a remove. Marcuse, Pollock, and Horkheimer, who were the most swept up by sort of the revolutionary organizations and ethos of this time. And the last things to cover are, is sort of like, okay, so what happens to all of this, this revolutionary elan in the 1930s and 40s, which are the last two decades of the period that we're discussing. And this is one of the things where, if we're talking about the theoretical content of their works, Adorno and Horkheimer could probably be called utopian socialists during the 1940s, including during the composition and publication of Dialectic of Enlightenment, not in opposition to scientific socialism per se, but because of the position they thought that scientific socialists, like the kind they were in the 1930s, had been forced into by the movement of history itself, where all of a sudden the objective trend of history seems like it's against them. You wake up the next morning, and that's how slim of a difference there is between a scientific socialist who sees the trend of history moving along with them and sees sort of like the necessity or even necessary possibility of socialism just around the corner, and someone who is put into the position of being a utopian just because they're a socialist. So this is also when utopia will start to figure, it'll loom a lot larger in their works of the 1940s for this reason.
Yeah, and so throughout the 1930s, once they're in exile, they sort of take up in some ways, a more activistic approach, because they have a goal of sort of recreating the left-wing intellectual milieu that existed in the Weimar Republic in Germany on a more international level. At first, they're in Switzerland, then they move to France. They connect with a number of people in France, even with some more sort of liberal people in France, like Raymond Aron publishes something in their paper, who goes on to be the great conservative mouthpiece of the post-war period in France.
Yeah, they have some very funny, this could be a topic for another one, which is their relationship with dedicated political and principled liberals. Not huge fans of Raymond Aron, but they did expect him at the very least to be impartial as a social scientist minimally in order to get a lot of their stuff published. Though they would have to write him letters sort of like clearing off or signing off on to be character witnesses for various socialists that they tried to push through the Paris branch in order to get them to the United States, including like Marie Jahoda, who was an Austro-Marxist social democrat type who Aron was super suspicious of, and they basically had to assure him that she wasn't that much of a radical, and they honestly didn't think she was because she was a social democrat, but in order to get her through the Paris branch to the United States. But yeah, this is sort of like their 1930s stuff, which is they wanted to be something like a new Scientific International for basically partisan socialists, social scientists from across the spectrum, from, you know, anarchists to communists to social democrats. Sometimes they were a little bit skeptical about them at this point.
Yeah, and then in the 1940s, they moved to America in the late 1930s, most of them. Some of them, Adorno doesn't arrive until late 1930s because he's been spending time finishing up his PhD or something, some degree over in Oxford, I think. And one thing they do in the U.S. almost immediately is they're involved with helping other German refugees make the passage to America. So they're sponsoring them. They're giving them these sort of jobs, kind of
scholarships for work that's never going to fucking be produced. They were just writing checks at a certain point. And again, they're not particularly good with money. And they did run out of it, and they did leave some people hanging. And it was really fucking depressing for them also. But they were writing checks constantly for articles that they knew were never going to get written. All of it was just bullshit. And it was just a pretext for them to be able to sign off, $40 here, $50 here, just to constantly supply all of these people, as many as they could from their intellectual circles in Germany, especially, and sort of the extended network, with just enough money for most of the tail end of the 30s, even into sort of like the early 1940s, when they really didn't have the money to be doing that shit anymore. Oh, okay. So then the other thing that they did in the 1940s was that they had to pivot because they needed external sources of funding, which came kind of as a surprise to them, even though it shouldn't necessarily have done. When they had to pivot in this way in like 39, around the time that a lot of their bad breakups with other members, like the breakup with Fromm, which is a lot less based on theoretical differences that they did exist, but it sort of gets rationalized as primarily a theoretical driven split. And it's actually just like really petty shit over like money and handling it very poorly by Pollock and Horkheimer, especially at this time. So there's in the early 1940s, then when they have to shift to these broad social research projects that they keep trying to get funded for like a decade from 39 to 49 until they leave effectively, and most of which fail, like almost all of which are not approved. Very few of them are. These are sort of aimed at a kind of action research, they would have called it, to borrow a term from Kurt Lewin, who was sort of a frenemy colleague of theirs in their time in the United States in the 1940s. Famous Gestalt psychologist. I'm not supposed to say famous anymore for figures like Kurt Lewin, I imagine, also. Okay. But they wanted to do a kind of research that paired social scientific work with political education. And so they considered their studies in anti-Semitism and prejudice as entry points for creating scientific and educational institutions to address the germs of fascism in the United States, especially on account of what they saw was the problem of racism in the United States and the problem of there not being a radical workers' movement, basically, in the history of the United States. So this is something that shows up in their almost completely underread and forgotten labor study of 1945, I think the first manuscript is finished. And this is one where they worked with people like in the AFL and the CIO at that time before their integration in order to sort of train cadres of workers in factories to go run surveys on prejudiced attitudes among blue-collar workers, and then to intervene in some cases and experiment with different kinds of interventions, direct one-on-one interventions. So, like, this was a part of their work in the early 1940s, and it just wasn't funded after the fact, and it wasn't published, not because they thought the results were too depressing, but in large part because of editorial disputes between Adorno and Paul Lazarsfeld at the end of the 1940s. They also had a pretty ambitious, like, media program of counter-propaganda. They wanted to create anything from, Adorno at one point proposes, an anti-racist musical where the apparent villain, left-leaning Jewish psychoanalyst, turns out to be the good guy at the end, and it's supposed to be an educational experience for the viewers. Comic strips that make fun of caricatures of anti-Semites to sort of flip the script on them. At one point, Adorno recommends hiring George Gross for this task. And they also had sort of like, Horkheimer was committed to the idea of producing sort of an educational movie that was supposed to also in some way be a kind of mass public way of doing psychoanalysis, since you can't get the entirety of American society onto the couch to sort of test unconscious or like drive structures of the American viewing public. So they had some pretty insane plans here, but they did consider their scientific work, their public-facing work in the 1940s as basically continuous with a socialist scientific project.
One last thing to touch on before we wrap up is our own evaluation of them, because we don't want to make it out like they're perfect political, you know, geniuses, or even necessarily that they're particularly reliable political voices, although I would say they are most of the time. But this is sort of the issue that's always going to be present whenever you're talking about intellectuals: a conflict between class suicide and self-criticism of the bourgeoisie. And in our reading, when we look at the biographical history of most of these people, there are exceptions. Wittfogel was very involved politically. A few other people were. But ultimately, they opt for a sort of position as self-critical and self-consciously bourgeois academics. They're very attached to their European bourgeois academic way of life. They like having a wife to make do all of their writing for them, you know, to be able to just dictate to their wife or their secretary or whatever all the time and not even have to bother with writing stuff down physically, let alone working physically or, you know, dedicating, risking their life in a political struggle. Some of them come closer to that situation than others: Horkheimer, Wittfogel, etc. Adorno in particular stands out as maybe the one of the more apolitical members. Part of that is because he was considerably younger than a lot of the other people, so he was still pretty young during the actual revolutionary period in Germany. Didn't experience very much of that firsthand at all. But yeah, that's sort of like a little bit of a caveat at the end.
Yeah, and this is something where like the perspective here is, correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of it is taken from Hans-Jürgen Kroll, who is like an enthusiastic reader, especially of the early Frankfurt School, and honestly better than almost anyone else at the time, even than like scholars in their works in like the late 60s. And this is one of the things where like Hans-Jürgen Kroll has a better reading of Horkheimer's like communist book of aphorisms, Dämmerung, which was published in 1934, but which was written from 1926 to 1931, right before exile, which is one of the most, to use Horkheimer's preferred phrase for this at the time, unswervingly communistic texts that anyone in the Frankfurt School is ever going to write, under a pseudonym, of course, Heinrich Regius. But Hans-Jürgen Kroll is going to be throwing quotes from this into the face of, you know, like the heads of the administrative and educational heads of the Frankfurt School in the late 60s, and they're going to be furious with him for it. At one point in the piece that you translated, J.E., someone accuses Kroll of demagogy for referencing Horkheimer, one of Horkheimer's aphorisms from this period, about how bourgeois criticism of the proletarian movement is an illogical impossibility.
He gets called to order. I don't remember who exactly did that one, but he gets called to order several times by Habermas, who is sort of the heir of the liberal kind of turn that they make in the once they return to Germany.
And so this is one of the things where it's that part of the reason that doing an episode like this seemed worthwhile for us, and thanks for listening into this, because I know that we've been going for a long time, but we had quite a lot of shit to cover. Part of the interest in doing an episode like this is because a lot of this has been forgotten or let to fall by the wayside, and in part because of revisionist histories that members of the Frankfurt School, when it becomes the Frankfurt School in the 60s, that they'll give themselves. This is Horkheimer, for instance, who basically has a revisionist story that he experiments with and tries out different versions of, many of which ultimately stick. And a lot of people's readings of the early Frankfurt School are from the perspective of, you know, the narratives that the anti-communist Horkheimer, anti-communist by the late 50s, he's confused for a lot of the 50s, let's just put it generously, but anti-communist intransigently by the late 50s. He'll create the narratives that a lot of people still tell today. And they're not all that dissimilar from a lot of the narratives that, for example, Habermas will pick up on later when telling the story of the arc of the Frankfurt School. A lot of this stuff was lost. Much of it wasn't even published until the 80s and 90s. A lot of the esoteric material that we're referring to were the miscellany. And some of it still isn't. So this is part of an ongoing project of recovering this side of early critical theory from the 20s through the 40s. And so we hope for that reason that you smell what we're stepping in, and that this has been an interesting episode for you.
Yeah. That's all for today. As always, this is a free podcast. We do have a Patreon where you can support us. It's linked in the show notes or whatever they call it. We have a website.
We also have a lot of translations of this stuff and edited versions of this stuff, especially if it hasn't been published before, that we're trying to put up pretty frequently, as well as essays on it.
It's all linked in the fucking bio or whatever. You can find it there. You know what to do.